Good evening and welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joyner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joyner.
Good evening. Thanks for being with me tonight for The Joyner Report on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network and at UPRN 105.5 FM New Orleans. I'd like to remind you, you can also listen on your cell phone by dialing 704-631-4060 and entering the station ID code of 2899. Normally, I would be telling you guys to go to the chat room in Pal Talk, but for some unknown reason, Pal Talk seems to have crashed and burned. So for the chat tonight, we're going to openmindsforum.com. And it's free to register there on the forum, and I have a board there. And about halfway down the page, after you register, you enter the forum, and you'll see the Joyner Report board. You click on that, and then you'll see the Joyner Report chat room. And that's where we are. You know, I hate that Pal Talk is not working because I'm afraid a lot of my chat room friends aren't going to find us. But hopefully, if you're listening and you're used to being with us in the Pal Talk chat room, well, just go to openmindsforum.com and quickly register. Hopefully they will approve. We've got someone that's supposed to be expediting the approval process to get you on quickly. Look for the Joyner Report board and then look for the chat room once you get there. In other news, the Stephenville, Dublin, and Comanche, Texas area, we've begun to receive reports of flares. This started, I believe, Monday night, and we have some confirmed reports of flares. I saw two myself on Tuesday night. Now, the Empire Tribune in Stephenville did a story on UFOs, but the witness description certainly sounded like flares. And because they were looking back toward the Dublin area and the direction of the Brownwood military operating area, then I have a feeling they probably were flares. And if you've never seen them, they really are quite spectacular. They look like amber fireballs. But at the same time, I've gotten reports of objects unknown to the observer, one being a black triangle spotted near Comanche at 9 p.m. on October 20th. I hope to be able to investigate these sightings more thoroughly soon, but lately my personal life has been getting in the way of my UFO life, so that's the way it goes sometimes. My guest tonight is Nancy Talbot. She's president of the DLT research team, whose primary function is to investigate crop circles, a subject that I know little about. Some listeners requested I have Nancy on the show, and I readily agreed. I first met Nancy at the Ozark UFO Conference in Eureka Springs, Arkansas in 2008, but I barely got to talk with her there because there was just so much going on at the time. I really wish I had been able to sit down with her then, but this is the next best thing. Nancy has done a lot of work on the crop circle phenomenon around the world and has a scientific approach to her investigations that I can appreciate. She works with scientists on a continual basis, and she's also a co-author of Dispersion of Energies in Worldwide Crop Formations. Tonight, Nancy has asked that we focus primarily on findings of plants and soil in these mysterious circles. And I'm going to suggest, while we're talking, you may want to go to her website, www.bltresearch.com, to look at the photos presented there, and I think it will help you understand the research and what she's going to be talking to us about tonight. I know it helped me. You can see there, you know, with pictures, you know, what a plant node that's stretched actually looks like. And it sometimes helps to have a visual like that, I think. And for some of you, this will be Crop Circle 101, but it's a good place to start. And I plan on having Nancy back for some follow-up interviews, and she has graciously agreed. So I'm really looking forward to learning all I can tonight and in future broadcasts about crop circles with Nancy. Welcome to the Joyner Report, Nancy.
Well, thank you. Nice to hear your voice again.
Well, thank you. I really am sorry that we didn't really get to spend any time together in
Springs. You were mobbed, and I clearly saw that another time, another place was going to be better.
Yes, it was kind of a crazy time for me. That wasn't very long after the
Everybody wanted to hear all about Stephenville, of course.
Yeah, it wasn't very long, probably 3 months, and I still, you know, didn't really have my feet on the ground by that time, and I didn't know who a lot of the researchers were, but, you know, I did hear people talking about your presentation there, and they were very impressed, and I've had a couple of the MUFON International people, you know, say that they have been very impressed with your work and the scientific approach that you take. So, can you
want to get into Crop Circle 101 here?
Yeah, let's do that.
All righty. Well, what people should do if they have a computer is, as you said, go to the BLT Research Team website. It's BLT, just like the sandwich, BLTResearch.com. Once you get there, on the left-hand margin, you're going to see a bunch of different sections. And the first one you should click on is plant abnormalities, because that's what I want to talk about first.
Okay, that sounds good. So I looked at that this afternoon, and I found it very, very interesting that there actually are some things happening with plants in crop circles that are not normally seen.
Well, that's right, and that's one of the very important things we discovered. This work was all done back in the 1990s, and it involved a biophysicist in Michigan, whose name is William Levingood, John Burke, who's the B in BLT, who's a businessman, actually, in New York, but who had a very strong interest in the circle phenomenon as an avocational interest, and then myself. My last name is Talbot, and I'm the T in BLT. And what we decided to do was to take a really hard look at the physical evidence. You hear all the time in the UFO thing, well, there's no physical evidence. Oh, there's no physical evidence. Well, of course, that's not true in the UFO phenomenon necessarily, but it absolutely isn't true when you come to crop circles. And that was, I think, one of the things that attracted me to studying them. Of course, there's tons of physical activity. There are these thousands of plants that have been squashed or flattened or whatever. And then there are all the soils.
Normally, you said on your site that the crop circles are found in the cereal plants, right?
Primarily in cereal crops, meaning oat, rye, barley, and wheat.
Okay.
Also, though, crop circles, they can occur in anything as far as we can tell, because we have reports from all over the world of them occurring in vegetables, carrots, spinach, you know, green beans. I saw one occur in green beans. All sorts of plants, as well as full-grown corn. I mean, field corn, 10, 11, 12, 13-foot tall field corn.
Wow.
Bushes. So there's a huge range of vegetation, but normally the majority of them occur in cereal plants. And of those, a huge number occur in wheat, which is, of course, a major food crop around the world. So, once formation has occurred, what we started to do is I organized a whole bunch of field workers around the world in different countries, people interested in this, and we developed a protocol, a sampling protocol, so that each one of these teams was sampling the same way. You want to follow
mm-hmm.
exactly the same kind of format.
Mm-hmm.
And then we rented barns and things to dry the plants down, because you can't ship them from Europe or any real distance when the plants are wet, because they become filled with spores and they degenerate.
Moldy.
Yeah, moldy. So you have to dry them down. But at any rate, you know, we've figured out this whole way of getting things sampled and getting a protocol followed, training all these people, getting the samples taken, and then having them sent back here to the States for Levin Goods laboratory work. And what he discovered fairly early on were certain changes on the microscopic level that he thought were important. But the microscopic work is very tedious, and it wasn't long before he started to realize that the microscopic changes in the nodes translated to and were consistent with this node elongation. And nodes are these sort of knuckle-like protuberances along the plant stems.
Right.
They're usually in wheat, say three or four of them, depending upon the species. And it's at those joints, the nodes, where on that top one in particular, Levin Goods started to notice that there was elongation. They were stretched.
Uh-huh.
And the way we could tell this was we would sample, let's say, 500 to 1,000 plants from inside a formation. And then you go outside the formation, but in the same field, and you sample another 500 or 1,000 plants, the same basic number.
Those become your control plants?
Those are the controls. And then all you do, in this case, it's certainly not rocket science, you measure the nodes. And you keep a list. You do a statistical counting of exactly what those lengths are. Anybody could do this if you have a lot of time. What happened was over years and hundreds of different formations in dozens of different countries, we started to realize that consistently there was this apical or top node elongation. It was stretched consistently in the genuine formations when it was compared to the control plants, when that same nodes were controlled, you know, compared with control plants outside.
Well, that was finding number one. You did say in genuine formation, so let's clear that up.
You got to let me go on a little bit here farther.
Okay.
To show you how we can tell the differences.
Go ahead.
That's one of the signs, and it happens to be one of the visible signs. Sometimes that node elongation, that stretching, will be literally up to 210-15%. Now, if the stretching that's happened is only, let's say, 35%, you probably really couldn't tell that visually, just looking at it. But when it's up around 100 or 150 or 200%, it's clear as a bell. If you take a bunch of control plants inside with you as you walk into the formation, you can immediately tell that kind of elongation when it's present.
Right.
Well, then after a while, we started noticing another change consistently, and this was something we called expulsion cavities. These are holes blown out at the nodes, usually farther down, the second node beneath the seed head, the third node, and or the fourth. In other words, all the way down to the ground. Now, in these cases, we reasoned that what was happening was that some sort of energy, and we believe in this case it's microwave radiation, is heating up the moisture inside those plant stems. When you heat the moisture up quickly, what happens? It turns to steam.
Mm-hmm.
And the steam, of course, then expands and has to escape somehow. On the top part of the plant, that very top node, the tissue is very elastic. It's the newest, it's the youngest part of the plant. And it stretches. Farther down the plant stem, the tissues do not stretch. They're very firm. That's how the plant stands upright. And they don't stretch at all. And so as the moisture, which is collected in the nodes of these plants, as that moisture turns to steam, that top one, the steam will seep out. And as it does, it stretches the node. It stretches the fibers. And when it's gone, it leaves them stretched. They stay that way.
Mm-hmm.
Farther down the plant stem, as the steam pressure builds up, there's no place for it to go. Those nodes do not stretch. And so what happens is it simply blows a hole right out at the node. And then, of course, the steam is just like if you put a potato in your microwave oven. Now,
and they don't stretch.
The ones down farther down the plant
stem. Brittle.
No, they're just tougher. The fiber is, I mean, the plant, in order to stand up, the tissue layers build up and build up. That's how the plant is strong enough to stand upright.
Uh-huh.
And at the top of the plant, you have the newest, youngest, freshest tissues. They're much more elastic. The ones down at the base of the plant have been added to and added to, like a tree ring, you know? And they get stronger and stronger. And you can't, I mean, they don't stretch, at least not under this kind of pressure. And so the holes get blown out, and we realize that both of these changes in the plants could be caused by the same mechanism. This business of the moisture inside the plant stems being heated up very quickly with literally nanosecond bursts of this heat, causing the moisture to turn to steam and the steam then to cause the physical effects in the plant. At the same time, what we were finding was a series of growth abnormalities in the crop circle plants, in the seeds. We would take the seeds out of the formation plants, the samples, and also out of the controls. And the first thing that is done is that a certain number of seeds are removed from the samples and from the controls, and they're weighed, just to see if the weight is the same. It's pretty obvious when you do this work that the weight is not going to be the same in most cases. The seeds, in fact, in the formation plants will be dehydrated and weigh considerably less than the controls.
So they're just sort of puny seeds?
They're all dry and they're all dried up and, yeah, puny.
Hmm.
And this, again, is related to their exposure to the microwave radiation. I mean, what does microwave do? It heats up moisture, right? That's what microwaves do. We found...
It cooks it.
What?
If it's long enough,
it cooks it, yes.
Mm-hmm.
If the heat lasts long enough. Now, one of the things that we realized pretty quickly was that if the crop circle formed in young crop, green, vigorously growing and very moist. When the crop is young, it's filled with moisture. The seeds have not fully developed by that point. The plant starts to dry down once the seed is fully formed. But at that stage, the seed is still getting nutrients like crazy from the plant itself. And so when a crop circle occurs at that stage, the seed never develops normally. It doesn't finish its development. And the seeds, when you plant them, in other words, the next year's crop,
mm-hmm.
it will not grow normally at all. In fact, it grows so poorly that in most cases you would not get any crop if you were dependent upon the seed that came out of the formation.
So these findings are based on the stage of the plant at the time the crop circle is made.
That's one.
It might be young plants, it might be older plants, and there's different things that happen with those.
Correct.
Plants.
When these crop circles happen in mature crop, this would be mid-July and August here in the Northern Hemisphere, the seed is fully formed when the circle occurs. It's interesting, we see that the seeds will again be dehydrated, and they weigh less, but when those seeds are planted, these are the ones that are taken from mature crop where the circle is formed, those seeds will grow at up to 5 times the rate of normal, and they do it without water or sunlight for long periods of time.
Well, how could that be?
Well, wouldn't you love to know? Obviously, this was a major...
I mean, we know that plants require sunlight and hydration.
Well, what we discovered, I mean, it was the first really major discovery that we had made from studying the crop circle plants. And obviously, we were utterly intrigued with this result. I mean, if you could figure out how to replicate it, you could provide a seed stock that would, you wouldn't have to worry about droughts, and you wouldn't have to worry about floods, and you wouldn't have to worry about all kinds of things that farmers have to worry about right now. Well, I've got more to say about that, because Levengood did eventually discover exactly how to replicate that result. He can produce it now at will in all kinds of seed, because he discovered what causes it. And at the moment, it's enough for me to tell you that it's a very unusual electrical pulse, that if you take normal seed and you expose normal seeds to these electrical pulses, you can produce that exact same result. An increased growth rate, increased yield, and increased tolerance to lack of water and lack of sunlight.
Is this what he got the patent on?
Correct.
Okay.
Now let me go on, because I got to tie one more thing into this before coming back to the patent idea. While we were doing this work, an accidental discovery, and this happens all the time in science, a formation was reported that had occurred in England during the Perseid meteor shower. This is in August. The formation was found to have what looked like molten metal splattered in between some of the seed heads and on some of the leaves. That material turned out to be an iron, a very fine iron that had been molten when it hit the plants. And eventually, after quite a bit of work, it was thought that most likely this was residue from the Perseid meteor shower, that these tiny droplets of iron, which are coming into the atmosphere all the time from meteor showers, not just the Perseids, but any of them, that these particles had been attracted into this plasma vortex system, which Levengood was beginning to conceptualize as the energy system causing crop circles. It's known that plasmas, when they spiral, emit microwaves. It's known that plasmas are also associated with these very unusual electrical pulses. And it's also well known that spiraling plasmas, like a lightning bolt, for instance, have very strong magnetic fields associated with them. The discovery of this molten iron in the crop circles in southern England at first, and now we see evidence of this in many cases, suggested then also the presence of these strong magnetic fields. So now we've got microwave radiation, or something that's acting just like it, a very unusual electrical pulse, which I will explain a little bit better, that Levengood was able to demonstrate was present, and also these strong magnetic fields. And in fact, the only known energy system in nature that is associated with all of those things, and which could possibly be involved in this, the crop circle phenomenon, is a discharge of a plasma system. Now, a lightning strike is much too intense a plasma discharge. It would fry the plants and destroy tears up the ground. The Northern Lights, which are another well-known plasma discharge, unfortunately, though they occur at 6, 7, 8 miles above the Earth's surface, Levengood was proposing that there is perhaps some sort of plasma system that is unknown to the science world at the moment, but that does reach the Earth's surface in nowhere near as violent a condition as a lightning discharge. And that such a plasma then could be the cause behind the crop circle phenomenon. Now, he's basing that idea, that hypothesis, on his own work, not on anybody else's, not on other ideas that other people have come up with. He based that simply on the physical changes he found in the plants, and the fact that he was able to replicate those changes in the laboratory. He was able to create elongated apical nodes. He was able to create expulsion cavities by, putting the plants into microwave ovens. He was able to reproduce the growth traits by exposing seeds to unusual electrical pulses. It was perfectly obvious from the magnetic material found in the soils and on the plants that a strong magnetic field had to be involved, and a spiraling plasma is known to be associated with all of those energies. So it's a foundation here. It's a starting point from which to be examining the crop circle phenomenon. There, no one else had applied any scientific approach, really. Most of the people interested in the crop circles don't have the science background or, you know, the ability. Mm-hmm. And many of them are not interested in the crop circles from that point of view anyhow. They assume that they are a metaphysical situation or a spiritual phenomenon and have therefore approached the crop circles only from that point of view, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are also a whole bunch of people who, I think from the beginning, had the idea that the crop circles were related to UFOs. Now, in the beginning, when I first was involved with all of this, I was absolutely 100% positive that UFOs, whatever they may be, had nothing to do with crop circles. I was positive. I would have put every cent I had on it. I have changed my mind since then. But in those early years, I was absolutely certain. And the reason I was, Angela, was that when I was a kid, I think it was the summer I was 14. I was in Maryland, and I was babysitting a bunch of kids one afternoon at a tea party, a cocktail party, for some friends of my mother's. And we were out, the kids and I were out in a big field playing ball, and all of a sudden there was this big silver thing that came in over part of the field and was hovering, and I was the umpire for the game, so I was looking in the same direction that the batter was and the catcher. And we three saw this simultaneously, this thing up in the air.
Wow.
It was actually not very high, it was kind of low. And it was maybe, I don't know, 80, 100 feet away. The kids out in the field saw it a second or so after we did. And as we each one saw it, we were apparently frozen. I don't know whether we were paralyzed or what. We couldn't move. We were in whatever position we were in when we saw it. And we couldn't move. We couldn't yell. I mean, we were simply held there. I had never heard of UFOs. And I thought it was... The first thing I thought was it was alive. My very clear impression was that it was alive. My second impression was that it was conscious and doing something, although I didn't have a clue what. And my third impression, and this was the one that made me think that the crop circles could not possibly be associated with UFOs, that third impression was that it was totally 100% indifferent to the results of whatever it was doing in regards to the children. It didn't intend harm. I had no sense that it intended harm.
But so you weren't frightened?
I was terrified.
Mm-hmm.
But not because I felt that it intended harm. The reason I was terrified was, number one, because I was paralyzed, which I didn't like, and number two, this second awareness that I had, which was that it was completely indifferent. If the job that day had been, if it had been told by its boss, go out and find a bunch of kids in a field somewhere, pick them up in the air 1,000 feet, drop them, and write down what happens. It would have done that with no more thought than if the instructions had been, go out and find a bunch of kids in a field somewhere and give them all ice cream cones. It literally...
So there was no feeling?
None. None. In a way...
No emotion.
I cannot
even... But you
still
felt it was alive.
Absolutely that I felt it was alive. I mean, remember, I knew nothing about crop circles. I was a kid. This was back in the 50s. And all of a sudden, I mean, I was aware of these things simultaneously, that it was alive, that it was doing something, you know, that I couldn't move, and that it was totally without emotion. In a way that nothing human can possibly be, you know. I knew it was just other, totally other, although I didn't know other what. And I don't know how long a period went. It can't have been too long because the parents would have noticed that there was no noise from the kids for a while. And so I'm thinking a matter of seconds before it suddenly released all of us simultaneously, and the kids started screaming, and everybody started running for the house. And apparently some of the parents heard the noise, got to the windows at the back, and saw this thing take off. And so as we were running into the house, it was the parents that I heard calling it a UFO.
Really?
And that was my first time I think I'd ever heard of a UFO. That's what they called it. And, of course, my intense curiosity running into the house was, what the hell was that? Well, the parents are, you know, calling it a UFO. And so my only personal direct exposure to what people call a UFO was totally different from any kind of impression that I've ever gotten around the crop circles, even though now other evidence has emerged, a whole bunch of evidence has emerged that indicates that at least some crop circles are absolutely associated with some UFOs. But at that time, you know, this was my very first experience of anything like this, and it's only been recently, actually, that it's come to, I've finally gotten to the point where it occurred to me that maybe there's more than one kind of UFO. I mean, they don't have to all be the same thing, coming from the same place with the same agenda. And perhaps there are some totally kindly disposed, or at least interested in human beings, UFOs. Maybe they're not all the David Jacobs variety, you know. But in that, in those early days, I mean, to me, a UFO implied, well, this business of being parallel, it implied bad things, not nice things, things I didn't like. And for the in the crop circle situation, there has been absolutely no suggestion of anything frightening or intimidating or aggressive or hostile. And so for me, for a great long time, I absolutely could not believe that there could be any association between the two phenomena.
Wow. Well, what convinced you there was?
Well, we'll talk about that in some of these future, you know, either the next hour or even after that. Partly, it's been this work with Robert Vandenbroeke in Holland and the amazing array of events that I have been witnessing with him for 10 years now, some of which directly involves UFOs, and his conviction that there are, in fact, many different kinds of UFOs representing many different cultures and different agendas, if you will, and that some of them are primarily interested simply in helping human beings become aware that there is a much larger reality than most of us stumble around our lives knowing about, you know? And those,
well,
he feels, are of a positive influence for mankind.
You know, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around some of these theories, or I don't know what you want to call them. I mean, some people don't even think they're theories. They just think, you know, it's the gospel. And it's
why
still kind
keep,
of difficult.
Yeah, why to keep an open mind and balance things?
Right. I believe that's true.
I don't see, I haven't yet seen the kind of proof. What I have seen indicates whatever the heck it is that's going on, it's much bigger, it's much more complex. There's no question that there's something very weird going on. I mean, that's beyond doubt once you get involved and you start paying attention. What it is exactly is what the big question is, and it's so widespread and so varied, and it changes, and there are so many aspects to it. I don't really think, I have never met anybody who I think has any sort of final answer on what it is that's going on. So I just keep an open mind and listen to a lot and read a lot and try to use my brains as much as I can.
But you're sure something's going on?
No doubt at all. I would not have thought that maybe 10, 15 years ago, but now I don't think that anyone who reads any of this material seriously, and my God, there's enough to fill Widener Library, if you read any of it with any real seriousness, you can't escape that something's going on. We don't have the answers to a whole bunch of stuff.
We don't. You're right.
And you see what's so interesting?
I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
In the chat room, okay?
All right.
Somebody wants to know, ask Nancy if a crop circle, this is my friend Obo, she says, if a crop circle can be identified as genuine, meaning not man-made, just by its pattern or without testing the plants, are the ones with swirled little patches in the center usually genuine?
There has been, the quick answer is no. There has been no scientific study of the lay of the plants. There have been many, many people who've commented about it, but there has been no consistent examination of the lay. And at the moment, the only criteria, the only published scientific criteria, is the stuff that we've published. And that includes the changes in the plants, the changes in the seed germination, the changes in the soils, which we haven't talked about yet. Those are the only known, reliable, in a sense of scientifically reliable data. Everything else is anecdotal, observational, and I'm not saying that the observations have necessarily been bad, but
mm-hmm.
they have not been put together in any conclusive fashion.
Well, is there a quick way to tell if the circle is man-made?
Well, there are some people, again, there's been no scientific study done that way, but
uh-huh.
what people would tell you is that one thing that I look at, for instance, is in older crop, you have to remember always you're talking about different kinds of crop that grows at different rates, it's at different rates of development when the formations occur. But generally speaking, if the crop is green, it's young, it's vigorously growing, it will have a lot of moisture in it. When the
mm-hmm.
crop starts to be brown, you know, or yellow, then it's drying down. In drying down crop, in the older crop, it's much easier to tell than it is in the young green. Common sense could figure this out. If you go into a field where the plants are drying down and brown, and you step on them, what's going to happen?
They're going to crack
exactly.
and break.
They're going to crack
mm-hmm.
and crush and break. And
mm-hmm.
so any sort of mechanical pressure, i.e. a board or a plank or somebody's feet or a cement roller, is going to crush the brown plants.
Uh-huh.
This is not so in the green, particularly in barley, which is very resilient. The hybrids that they use around the world are very resilient. You can mm-hmm. run a 50-pound roller over that stuff, and it'll bend over. It comes back up, but it doesn't crush it, not when it's green.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to be extremely careful in your evaluation of these things. I mean, I wish someone would take the time to do a very in-depth examination of lay details and tie it into the plant and soil work so that we would have some idea what was being represented. But nobody has done that yet. I mean, it's quite expensive to do all this work, as you can imagine.
I would guess so. I saw that some of your work was funded by Rockefeller.
Well, this gets into the X-ray diffraction study, and I did want to talk a little bit about the soils. There are two major soil pieces of information. One is the presence of these are nano-sized, microscopic-sized, round, spherical particles that are magnetic, and they're made up of pure iron. And we find them in the crop circle soils all the time. Now, what's interesting about them is not just that they're present in the crop circle soils and not so much in the control soils. It's
uh-huh.
also the manner in which they're distributed. Often they are collected around the center of the crop circle, just there. In other instances, they'll be collected just around the edges of the circles. And
okay.
in some cases, they're distributed linearly, meaning that the least amount would be at the center, and then a doubled amount would be 5 feet out, and that would double at 10 feet out, and that would double at 20 feet out.
Now, so like a centrifugal force?
Exactly. And when you're talking microscopic particles here, this can't happen by accident. This is, there's something going on there that is it's a very clear demonstration that this is not people taking microscopic particles and managing somehow to deposit precisely the right amount at all of these different distances away from the center.
That would be impossible.
Yeah, of course it would. I mean, it's like going around all the nodes with a heating iron, which some people have suggested, well, there's somebody out there with a hairdryer.
I don't think so. Man, they'd have to have a lot of time.
Have to have a lot of damn hair dryers, I think. I mean, they're saying they're going around to the plants with the hair dryers and heating up the nodes, you know. I mean, people come up with a lot of outrageous ideas when they just don't want to deal with it. And bless their hearts, I understand that. But it's ridiculous, you know.
Yeah, that is ridiculous. I mean, to think somebody could have that many hair dryers in that much time. I didn't even know that people complained that.
Well, and plus, think of the extension cords you'd have to have.
Yeah. I mean, no, that's not the answer.
No, don't think that's the answer. Anyhow, this X-ray diffraction study that Rockefeller funded, he heard about our work at a certain point and asked me to come to New York to, which people like to have you tell him everything, you know. So what the heck, he's got the money. I go, I told him, you know, what we've been doing and what we've found. And he was interested in the work and suggested that he would fund, perhaps, for a future study. And what would I propose? Oh, dear God, I almost fell off my chair. You know, it's like, oh, my God, I think of a thousand things here. So I went
so
back.
So did you say, well, just give me $5 million and let me run?
I didn't think that was wise. It didn't strike me as that was the way to go about this. So I came home here and conferred with a number of people, and we tried to figure out what would be a reasonable next step. In science, you try to always base what you're doing, the next step, on previous steps. You try to add to them. And since one of the major ideas that we had come up with already was that heat was involved, probably microwaves, but heat of some kind was affecting the plants and the soils, and we had a geologist a friend of mine who had written a thesis on the effects of heat on clays in the soils, and she knew that the clay minerals in soils generally were more sensitive to heat than some of the other components, and she had done some preliminary work on a crop circle that occurred in Logan, Utah back in, I think, 97, 96. And her testing, which was very preliminary, seemed to indicate that there might be a change in the crystalline structure of the clay minerals in the crop circle soils. Well, I knew that if we could get a result like that, that would be a stunning result.
Right.
But I knew also that X-ray diffraction cost a couple thousand dollars a pop, and had no idea that we could afford that. So eventually...
How much?
A couple thousand bucks to have each sample done. The clay's extracted, and then they have to be mounted in the machine, and then the machine does its thing. It bounces the X-rays off the sample, and it produces a graph, and then the graph has to be interpreted.
Wow.
And it takes someone, a material science engineer, somebody who specializes in that sort of work.
Okay.
At any rate, that was the study we ended up deciding that we're going to do. And so I wrote up a proposal, and he did fund it. And we did, in fact, then go ahead and do this. And it was very interesting when I think back on how these things have turned out now. We had a number of different possible, circles to use. Mm-hmm. And I had four or five different ones in different countries sampled for this study. We had only enough money to do one in depth, because we're talking many, many, many samples here, not just one or two. And I knew we could only do one properly, but I wanted to pick the most reasonable candidate because I didn't want to waste the money. And so we sampled a whole bunch of different ones. All the stuff came in. Then we had to test the soils, because the first thing we had to do was see whether or not there was enough clay in the soils. It varies enormously from field to field and country to country, you know. Mm-hmm. And some of the test cases were thrown out because there just wasn't enough clay. Then in another case, some of the sampling hadn't been done properly, so that had to be thrown out. We ended up with a case in Edmonton, Canada, that was a seven circle kind of thought bubble looking thing that had appeared in a field of, Canadian thistle. It must have been barley. It was barley, but the field was infested with Canadian thistle, which is something that will scratch your eyeballs out and definitely scratch your legs to ribbons if you go in without, you know, heavy boots on.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where it had happened. And as it turns out, I found out later, there was three witnesses that we know of, and we think two other, to a UFO right over that field just before that crop circle was found. But at the time, I didn't know that. So we picked this place because the sampling had been done properly, the content, the clay minerals in the soil were adequate. You know, we could get the work done in a timely fashion. And so we did. And the results of the test seemed to be coming back that indeed we did have a slight change in the crystalline structure of the clay minerals in that particular crop circle. When those results came back, none of us really believed it, and I was hiring people who had never heard of crop circles before. The material science guy who did the X-ray diffraction work on the West Coast, he literally never heard of crop circles. I then hired a statistician who had been at MIT. He'd never heard of crop circles. What I was trying to do here was to avoid any bias whatsoever in the results.
Uh-huh.
So we took the results
and
sent them to the statistician, and he then did this very standard work, which clearly showed that, yes, in fact, we did have a change in the crystalline structure. It was more ordered, is the way they call this, on the atomic level. It was more organized. Now, the only way that something like that can happen is, in geology, this is the only way it is known to happen, is when you have mountains, literally mountains, the pressure of mountains pressing down on sedimentary rock over mm-hmm. hundreds to thousands of years. Mm-hmm. It's the pressure of the mountains and the heat from the Earth's core that changes the crystalline structure of these clay minerals. It's the only way it's known to happen.
That makes sense to me.
As much as I knew, it made some sense to me, too. I knew that the results were, they were going to be amazing if they were for real. I was lucky enough to go and get a man who was the world's authority on clay mineralogy at the time, probably still is, a professor of earth sciences at Dartmouth College, the head of the department, whose name is Robert Reynolds. He has since died. But at the time, he was head of the Mineralogical Society of America, head of the Department of Earth Sciences, although he was emeritus at the time I was working with him. And he's the guy who wrote the textbook on X-ray diffraction technique and clay minerals. And I got to him and was absolutely amazed when he agreed to look at our work. What I wanted was to find out if he could find any flaws in the work, you see.
Uh-huh.
And at first he looked at it and he said, oh, there must be something wrong here. You made a mistake. There's something wrong with the machine, or the guy didn't know, you know, whatever. And he asked if he could see the mounts, all the actual samples.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the guy in California send a whole bunch of them to Dr. Reynolds in Dartmouth. Reynolds then, using his own X-ray diffraction machine, went ahead and redid the work. And he got exactly the same result. Then he thought, well, if he's getting the same results, maybe the statistics were wrong. So he wanted the statistics all redone, and he ended up redoing them himself also. When he got the
he
same
was intrigued.
Answer, yeah, when he got the same answer that we had gotten, he then wanted a whole bunch of other tests done because it occurred to him that other things might be playing a role here. We did every single thing he asked, and finally he said to me, that we absolutely had the result at the 95% level of confidence. There was no question that in his mind, the clay minerals in the crop circle soils, the crystalline structure was more ordered than in the controls. This had never been seen in surface soil before. the only way that it could possibly happen in surface soil, according to him, was if there had been temperatures of the 600 to 800 degrees Celsius range for a period of many hours. Now,
and pressure, or just the heat?
No, just if there had just been this kind of 600 to 800 degrees Celsius heat, that might cause it, he said. The problem, of course, is that had there been heat of any kind, the plants would have been burnt up. And they weren't.
That's right. And they weren't.
And they weren't. So the end result was that he determined that the effect was real, that this actually was present in those soil samples, and that he personally could offer no explanation as to how that could have occurred. Now, it wasn't until quite some time after that that I realized that I found out, in fact, that there had been this UFO incident over the field just before the crop circle was discovered. I didn't find out about that till some time later.
And where was this one?
Edmonton, Canada.
Okay, Canada.
Outside of Edmonton.
So later you found out there was a UFO over the field.
Over the field.
You didn't know
the
it
farmer
at the time.
And his wife had seen it and neglected to tell us that little detail. And then we found there were other witnesses, and we were able to track down a couple of them who had been driving by the field on one of the roads that bordered the field and had this encounter with a huge UFO right smack over the field where the circle, in fact, was found a couple days later. The farmer didn't find the circle until he was going to harvest. It was at harvest time that he found them.
Uh-huh.
They were in a place that you would never have seen them otherwise. But it appears that the UFO was over that field right around the time, just before they were discovered. Now, this doesn't prove that those circles were, in fact, caused by that UFO, but it's a kind of a weird coincidence.
Well, I think it would be. That's what I was thinking. Because, what are the chances? You know, that would be pretty phenomenal in itself.
Well, you hear about it once, and you say, well, maybe coincidence. I've heard it so many times now. It can't be coincidence the number of times I've heard it. And with the other evidence, other experiences I've had, and things I've observed, I am positive now that something that many of us call UFOs, whether it's the same kind of UFO that everybody else sees, I don't know, but some things which humans call UFOs are involved and present in some of the crop circle cases, at least. Whether it's, you know, whether it's related to all crop circles, I don't know.
Hmm. Okay, you know, and Rockefeller funded this for you, Lawrence Rockefeller, and you know, Grant Cameron has uncovered quite a bit of interesting material about Rockefeller being involved with the Clintons. Did you know that?
Yeah, and I, you know, frankly, I have heard a lot of things that people say about Rockefellers and Rothschilds and rich people. I mean, it's a different world, you know. Rich people live in a really different world. Rockefeller, to me, and in our interactions, was totally businesslike, completely open. There was no funny business at all.
Uh-huh.
An arrangement was made. With certain parameters were set out. He did exactly what he said he was going to do. I did exactly what I said I was going to do. There was no attempt in any way to influence. He was interested genuinely in the factual information. He was much more interested in the science than in the other approach to the whole thing. He wanted to know. And he was willing to put, this was his personal money, this was not the Rockefeller Foundation.
Uh-huh.
When he's been involved in UFOs and stuff, it's always been his personal money, because it was a personal interest of his. He died not too long after we finished our study,
mm-hmm.
because I know he was interested and wanted to know himself, just like the rest of us. He wanted to know what was going on. I think people judge, I don't know all the rest of the Rockefellers. I don't know what they're like, and I'm sure they're not all the same. Lawrence seemed like he's definitely intelligent and sensitive, very interested in a lot of the same things I was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he truly was interested, and Grant has a photo of Hillary Clinton walking with him, and you know, the gist of it was that he was pressing or trying to press Bill Clinton into being the disclosure president, but you know,
I don't know. I mean, Rockefeller and I did talk about a number of things, but I mean, the man's not with us anymore, and exactly all I know is that in the crop circle thing, he helped establish certain very important facts, and I'm grateful that he was interested enough to, you know, to help us do that.
Okay, we're at the top of the hour. It's 10 o'clock now, Central Standard Time. Do you think you can make it another hour? I know you're not feeling well.
Yeah, I think I'll be all right.
Okay, we're going to take about a 10-minute break. So just lay your phone down, Nancy, and take a break. And in about 9 minutes, we will come back at UFO Paranormal Radio Network, and we'll talk more with Nancy Talbot. Thank you. All right. Thanks for being with me tonight. We have a special two-hour broadcast on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network and at UPRN 105.5 FM New Orleans. Tonight, my guest is Nancy Talbot. We've already been speaking for an hour, and Nancy has so much information. We decided to do a two-hour show tonight, and we will also be doing further interviews in the future. We just have to set up some dates where we can both get together, and I'm very impressed with the work that Nancy's done, and her scientific approach. It's just been incredible work. If you have not already, if you joined us in the first hour, I suggested you go to www.bltresearch.com so that you can follow along with photos of what Nancy is telling us about as far as plants and how they are affected in crop circles, as well as how the soils are affected. And welcome back, Nancy. Here we go, another hour.
I am so pleased that you were able to do this, Angela. It really makes such a difference, because with you, where our talk is not interrupted every 2 seconds by an advertisement.
Isn't that nice?
Oh, it's incredible. And you get to express a whole thought and to hear whole questions. Oh, I love it.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it, because I certainly am. And I think probably what we should do is kind of recap what we had talked about in the first hour so that we can proceed from there for people that might just now be joining us.
Okay. Basically, what we've established is that a certain amount of plant and soil work has been done on crop circle plants and soils. This was done over a 10, 11, 12-year period involving crop circle samples from, I think it was something like 17 countries that we did overall, several hundred crop circles themselves, sampled in depth with this many, many, many plants and many, many soil samples. The results of all that work showed us that when crop circles are not man-made, when they occur in whatever way it is that they are, the phenomenon is actually occurring, what we find are consistently elongated or stretched apical nodes. That is the top node just beneath the seed head on the plants. We find expulsion cavities, which are holes blown out farther down the plant stem node, although the expulsion cavities are not always present in a genuine formation. It depends on the amount of moisture in the plant, and it depends on the amount of microwaves in the energy system. but okay. they are frequently present in the genuine situations. Then there are also all sorts of growth changes. If you took the seeds from the crop circle plants and planted them and also took some of the control seeds, you would then notice some very striking differences in the crop circle growth habit compared to the controls. In young plants, if the circle happens when the plants are young, essentially those plants are sterilized. The seeds, although partially formed, will not develop and they will not grow new plants. In mature crop, where the seed is completely formed when the crop circle happens, this is towards the end of the summer, those seeds will also be dehydrated and weigh less, but they will grow at up to 5 times the rate of the controls. They will produce greater yield, and they will do it if they're deprived of sunlight or water for long periods of time.
Which, that's the most astounding thing to me,
isn't it?
Is these plants will grow in a drought without sunlight. I mean, that's just incredible.
Well, you know how we discovered, strange how we discovered that. There was a crop formation that had happened in California, and the guy had, he had done his own samples in this case and his own controls, and they had arrived, they were not dried down in this case. Whenever we're working overseas, we have to rent barns and hang up all the plants and dry them down for a couple months before they're shipped. But here in the States, we tend to ship them right away.
Uh-huh.
And so this guy had done that. They'd arrived at the lab, and Levengood had opened up the box right away and had taken some of the plants and some of the controls out and started to work with them. And he closed the box back up, and it kind of got kicked underneath a shelf or something. Well, he went ahead and worked with the samples and the controls that he'd taken out, was doing the various things he does, and completely forgot about this box. He had a habit of taking any extra plants, and after he was finished, whatever plants were left, they have to be incinerated in a certain way to be in compliance with all the agricultural, you know, regulations. And he would routinely, at least once a week, sometimes twice a week, do that to dispose of all the extra, you know, plant material. And I guess he thought that he had done that with this particular box. And so it was a week, 8, 9, 10 days later when he discovered the box was still there.
Uh-huh.
And he opened it up, and to his total amazement, all of the sample plants were bright green and growing vigorously, and the controls were dead as doornails.
And that sounds impossible.
Well, that was the first clue we had.
And then it was discovered by accident.
But totally, so much of science is that way.
It is,
something you stumble upon. Once he saw that, he then started testing it in all the samples and controls that came in. And sure enough, when the circle had been in mature crop, this was then a consistent result. And obviously one of the most interesting. Now, I didn't get to finish this part. He did a lot of testing over the next couple of years to try to figure out what in the world could have caused this. And eventually discovered that a certain kind of electrical pulse, if administered to perfectly normal seeds, would cause this same kind of increased growth, increased yield, and increased tolerance to what they call a plant stressors, you know, lack of water or sunlight.
Right.
And it took a lot of work with many different kinds of seeds, but he eventually narrowed down exactly what kind of pulse with, say, tomatoes, or cotton, or wheat, or corn, or whatever. And he and John Burke, who was working with him on this, applied for a patent for this piece of equipment, which they were given. And they then spent a considerable amount of time trying to market that technology. And unfortunately, I guess this is what happened. I mean, what John Burke tells me is that all of the major seed companies, like Monsanto, were told about this. John went and did all sorts of trials for them. They would give him seed, which he would treat, and then they would send it back, and Monsanto would grow it out to see if they would get the same result, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this happened all over this country and in many other countries around the world. John went everywhere trying to market this. And all of the major seed companies, by this time, had invested huge amounts of money in genetic modification. With genetic modification, these seed companies control the seed, you see. They control it entirely, where in the past the farmers have had control of the seed. Apparently, and according to John, they could see no way to have long-term control over this technology, and therefore just ignored it. They got exactly the same results that we had. The University of Florida did a study. They got
well,
the results.
Well, that seems almost criminal whenever, you know, it would feed the world in drought-stricken areas or environments that normally aren't conducive to growing food.
Hello?
That's horrible.
Hello?
It's outrageous.
I think so, too. But this appears to be what happened. Now, John and Lefty created a company called Proceed Tech. And on, if you go to the BLT website, BLTResearch.com, and open up the plant abnormalities page and scroll down, I think it's item 7,
uh-huh.
You will see this entire thing discussed, exactly what was found, exactly what they did. And they called it the MIR stress guard technique. And there was a link there for the longest time to Proceed Tech, their website, but it's been closed now because there was, you know, they just weren't unable to get the technology out.
They must have been so disappointed.
Yes, I think so, and as you said, rightfully so, because it's a very simple, fairly straightforward technique. It's not expensive. It could be made available to countries like Africa, where something like this could be a major impact. But it doesn't keep the seed companies on top of the food chain, which appears to be what they're trying to do.
Well, that is just a shame. And, you know, the thing that comes to my mind is, well, you know, you've got to get somebody that's very vocal to let people know about this and, you know, some movie star or something. I mean, this is exactly the type of thing that probably Michael Jackson would have pounced on to spread the word. Somebody that has a platform should really be pushing this.
Well, what I have found, Angela, it's so strange. I mean, we have done... we published 3 papers in the scientific literature. We're the only group in the world that's done anything like this. We do it by having our nose to the grindstone instead of being out there blathering about ourselves. We're working. And it seems like the people who in any area are doing the most work in the area are the very last ones that anybody ever hears about because they're busy doing the work. I mean, we don't happen to have contacts with famous people like that. I mean, I agree that if we could get one and they could understand what was available here and jump on this bandwagon, that's what it would take. Because when you're up against major financial interests like Monsanto, I mean, you haven't got a snowball chance in hell unless you've got that sort of support on your side, you know?
Have you ever tried Bigelow?
I had an interaction with him some years ago that led me to think we were better pursuing doing what we were doing on our own.
Okay. That wasn't positive then, I gather.
What? That wasn't what?
I guess that wasn't a positive experience then.
No. It's not necessary to go blabbing about it, but no. I mean, it was clear to me that if you wanted to do the kind of work, I mean, we're trying to find out what's going on. We don't have a bias. We don't know what's going on. I did have certain ideas in the beginning, which I pretty much abandoned now because I was wrong. But, I mean, the interest, what motivates us and all of the various scientific people who work with BLT as consultants, is simply that they want to understand something, you know, better than we do. Nobody's invested in it. Nobody's making any money, for the Lord's sake. In fact, everybody's spending money to get the work done. And the only motivation is to, just like everybody else, we simply want to understand. And we know that if you're trying to reach the larger uninitiated public, I mean, there are many people who have seen things and who know things just personally, But if you haven't had those experiences and you don't know because of your own experiences, you know, there's this whole tickle factor, this ridicule thing that people laugh, and less so than they used to, sure, but it, a lot of people just don't.
I was amazed
that you really were.
I didn't even know that this whole UFO community existed, and boy, you know, I always say when the UFO bug bit me, it got a big chunk, because my life has totally and drastically changed, and it's just been so interesting. But let's say, Nancy, if someone gave you $1 million, if they just said, here it is, I believe in you, I believe in your work, here's $1 million, what would you do with it?
Well, I'd love to tell you I'd buy an island in Tahiti and say the hell with it all. But I don't think that's what I would do. What I would do, actually, I'm almost certain, is I would invest some of it in more work on the physical evidence. We've also worked on UFO cases, as you know, and on the cattle mutilation deaths. We've done quite a bit of work in those areas. And I can see many more things to be done if we had the cash to on the physical evidence in all of those types of events. But because of some of the more recent experiences I've had and things that I've witnessed, particularly in Holland, although not exclusively there, there's a young man in Holland, his name is Robert Vandenbroeke, and I first knew about him when he was, I think, 14. He is the only person in the world, as far as we know, who, I don't know what the words are. Does he have visions? Does he have dreams? How does he do this? We don't know. But he knows when a new crop circle is forming in his general area.
How old is he now?
He's now 29. And my first involvement was around a glowing, huge ball of light that had suddenly appeared over this small balcony off his bedroom. They live in a small village in southern Holland, and there's a big farm right behind their house.
Uh-huh.
And there had been suddenly this ball of light one night appeared, big. It sounds to me like it had to be 12 feet in diameter or so, revolving right out side of these floor-to-ceiling glass doors that open out onto this little balcony. And he and his sister were in the room listening to music. It scared the dickens out of them. They went running downstairs to get their parents, and when they came back up, the ball of light was gone, but the eaves were burned, the outside of the door had burn marks on it, and there was a pile of white powder sitting on the balcony floor. White powder. And the father, who was at that time a bank president, this is an upper-middle-class guy, not into this sort of thing at all, he wants to find out what the heck this white powder is. And somehow or other, the information got to one of our field workers in the Netherlands, and they called me to find out if our guys could do the analysis. And so the material was sent here to the States, and we did do the analysis, and the results were sent back. And then later, about a year later, I was doing a lecture in Amsterdam, and so the whole family came to thank me for having gotten this analysis done. The powder, as it turns out, was a very, very pure magnesium carbonate. Now, magnesium, as you probably know, is used in flares, and in that case, it would have been magnesium oxide, but magnesium is the base material. There is no situation anywhere around Robert's house. There's no military installation. There's nothing of any sort like that. We could find no explanation for why magnesium carbonate in this very pure form would be on his balcony. Well, when I met them a year later, I happened to have a couple of extra days. I was doing a trip to a couple different countries, and they asked me to come to their home. I think they just wanted to talk a little bit more. And I had a strong desire to know a little bit more about Robert, because in that year, another thing had started, which he had started to know when these crop circles were happening. He saw a couple of them form with his own eyes, and I had not heard of anybody else who could do this, so I was curious in, you know, knowing more about him. Anyhow, I went down there, and the first night I was in the house, the one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, I had this funny feeling. I'm a night person, so it's sort of normal that I'm up late. But in that case, I had jet lag and everything, and I would have thought I'd have gone right to bed. But I didn't. I had this feeling not to go to bed, and I just couldn't. So the parents, who are very, you know, very elegant as hosts, they wouldn't go to bed if I wouldn't go to bed. So the three of us were sitting downstairs. Robert had gone to bed. His sisters were in bed. Just the parents and I. And we were sitting in a living room directly beneath Robert's room. And there are floor-to-ceiling glass doors there that open out onto a small garden, just a little patio and garden, which is real typical in Europe. Everybody has these. And while we were talking, I had my back to these windows. Suddenly, the father jumped up. He was facing the windows. And he shouts, "There, there, there, that's what we're talking about." And he had seen a flash of light out in this little garden.
Uh-huh.
So I turned my chair around so I was facing the windows because I hadn't seen it. And he turned down all the lights in the downstairs so it was real dark there. And we just sat and were watching this little garden. Well, all of a sudden, this tingling thing started. I was sitting, and it started at my waist, front and back, and started to move up my body fairly slowly, but getting stronger and stronger and stronger as it got higher and higher. And it got into my neck area, and by then it was almost like sticking your finger in an electric socket. Not quite that strong, but it seemed like it was heading in that direction, you know? And at that point, I mentally thought, the hell with science, I'm getting out of here, because I was afraid. And the instant I had that thought, the tingling stopped, and this incredible light show then took place immediately in front of those windows. And there were balls of light, and there were flashes of light, and there were blobs of light that came down from above and bounced along the patio floor. I mean, it was like watching a three-ring circus. I've never seen anything like it. And it lasted for, I think, 15, 20 seconds, and then it stopped, and it was dead quiet. There was no sound. Parents hadn't said a word, and nobody said anything, and I'm thinking, what, did I just see that? Well, then it started again, and the tingling slowly, slowly, slowly up the body, and again, it got to around my neck area, and was getting too, it wasn't comfortable anymore, you know, and again, I'm thinking, okay, I am out of here, and before I could,
that had to be so scary.
It was, in the beginning, it was. And then the second I had the thought, it stopped, the physical stuff stopped, and here come the light bulbs again. And they're big ones, and they're little ones, and they're flashing lights, and they're blobs of light, and they're tubes of light, all within about a 12 by 12 area immediately in front of those glass doors. Well, this continued, we think, we don't know for sure whether it was 5 or 7 times, with a pause in between each time, with the electrical thing building up each time. Nobody spoke during the entire event, which took about 11 minutes. I finally, towards the end of it, I didn't have the guts to go outside, but I got right smack up against these windows so I could look up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing up there except sky. But the same thing happened, you know, over and over and over. And then all of a sudden, I turned around to the parents. This is God talking now, you know? And I say, well, that's it. It's over. Now, I haven't got the faintest idea why I said that. I have no idea how I knew.
You said what now?
I said, that's all. It's over.
It's over.
It's over.
You just knew it was over.
I just knew it was over. And by this time, the father, he is traumatized. He is not a happy camper, did not like this at all. The mother wasn't as shell-shocked. I separated them. And then I went, I talked to the father first because he was so upset. And what I was trying to find out was whether they had witnessed the same thing I did. Did they see what I saw? And did they physically feel? Because none of us had spoken, you see. So I had no idea what they were actually experiencing. Turns out that all three of us did feel and see the same whatever. You know, whatever that was, we all felt and saw it the same way.
That's amazing.
It was. I thought so, too. And the father turns to me and says, well, that's for you. That's because you're here. And I thought about that, and that wasn't my personal impression at the moment. My impression was that it was absolutely location-specific. It happened on purpose in that space. Now, I was...
Because you were there?
Well, that's what his father thinks. I don't know because I was there. But it definitely happened in a very contained area. Now, since that time, this whole thing with between Robert and me has taken off. He and I have a... He speaks Dutch and I speak English. And we're totally different cultures. You know, he's a kid, I'm an old bat. But we have some sort of a totally spontaneous, natural understanding. We've worked up a way we can talk to each other. He speaks some English. And we've come up with a number of ways of... I mean, it seems like we communicate completely easily. It's no problem. And we understand things very similarly. And in his presence now, because I've been going there and staying, I stay with the family for 2 or 3 weeks every year. So I know the family. I mean, it's like I'm part of the family. I know exactly who they are and how they are and what they think and what goes on. And these events around Robert have simply mushroomed unbelievably. There are, on the website, on my website, the BLT research site, I've now started a whole page for Robert Vandenbroek. It's entitled The Vandenbroek Case, if you go onto the left margin.
Yeah, I saw that.
Well, on that page, there are some new reports that will be going up. This one on the UFO photos will go up on November 7th, I think. And then there's another one about photographs he takes of people who have died that will be coming up very soon, too. But right now, there are a whole bunch of reports explaining some of these events that go on around him, this way that he knows when a new crop circle is forming, this white powder which occurs over and over, and in fact, a week ago has now occurred again. I just got the sample in the other day. There is an ongoing series of events which seem to include poltergeist activity, out-of-body experiences, remote viewing, apparitions or ghostly presences, ETs, UFOs, traveling...
Okay, let's slow down a little bit here, Nancy. Now, you said that he knows, and somehow intuitively, you don't know exactly how... He knows when and where crop circles will form.
Correct.
He has taken photographs of people that have passed on, and they appear in these photographs. He's even done it with your own camera, with you standing there.
Done it many, many times with my own camera and many other people's. I mean, this is...
Well, Nancy, that's all a little hard to swallow, don't you think?
I'm sure it is. If people, that's why I'm trying so hard to get one fact, one series of facts about him at a time presented so people can absorb it. There are a lot of people now, I mean, in Holland he is known as a medium. He has a list of clients there. I mean, they wait years to see him. He does healings. He does readings.
So does he charge for these things?
No, Robert himself would never charge for anything. His father encourages donations because Robert has no ability to earn a living. He has nothing else that he can do, and the father is very concerned, you know, being a banker type, he's worried about how Robert will live when the parents die.
What do you mean he has nothing else he can do for a living? Is he not able to... I mean, he's not able to take a normal job, and
no,
if so, why?
Could not possibly. I don't, it's a very complex thing, and I'm writing a book which will, I hope, explain some of it for people. But since he was about 6 years old, really I think it began when he was about four, but throughout his very young childhood, he has always seen the dead people, always. He thought everybody did. He had absolutely no idea that they didn't. It was...
Is it something like the movie The Sixth Sense, where the little boy says, "I see dead people"?
I don't know. I haven't seen the movie. But Robert would see and has always seen people who have died. He also sees creatures and beings from other places and has started photographing these fairly young. He has literally now, his father has archived this stuff, and there are easily 10, there could be 20,000 photographs now that he has taken over these years. Once this started, his parents thought he was crazy. They put him in a hospital. They had him evaluated for psychiatric illness. It turned out that the doctors could find nothing. He's very intelligent, and there's nothing. I mean, he's absolutely like you and me, except that he has all this stuff going on. And so
he's not like you and me.
No, he is. He's a very human person.
Okay.
He's not. He doesn't walk on water. He's not into guru ship or any of that stuff. He likes French fries and Cokes. He's getting fat because you eat too many French fries and Cokes, you get fat. You know, he's a lot like us, but he has an access. What I come to think after seeing him for years is that what he really is what he calls himself, a medium. He's a conduit through which whatever this is, and I think there are many of these whatever it is, it's not just one thing, they can come through him, they can manifest through him, and they do. And some of it will then turn into making crop circles, and sometimes it's a UFO appears. Sometimes, you know, Robert, his clients now are telling me, because I interview his clients, a lot of them, that they see Robert's body in their homes when he's sitting there in his living room with me. And I know he's right there. But
okay, so you're totally convinced, aren't you?
I've seen so much now, there's no way. If this kid was faking this, he'd have to be a genius. And he'd have spent his entire life doing nothing else but. And it's just not the way it is. This last summer.
Now, you have been with him, am I correct in saying that you've been with him when he predicted a crop circle, and you were with him, and it absolutely appeared in front of you?
Yes, I've had that happen twice, actually. And no, wait a minute. No, in the first case, he and I were together, and this is on the Eyewitness Reports page. It's also on Robert's page. And this is the Tubes of Light incident. And in that case, Robert and I had been out in the fields for 2 weeks lugging an electromagnetometer with us because I was doing a study for Dr. William Roll. And we didn't get a damn thing. No results, I mean, no differences at all. We were going to all these crop circle fields to see if there were any differences, you know. And I was sick and tired of it. It was hard work climbing up over these dikes and barbed wire fences and stuff. And I was tired and I was hot and I was annoyed. And we were in the kitchen, I don't know, 2 or 3 o'clock one morning, and he wanted to go back out into the circles, because there were circles around, because he liked to take pictures. He got weird pictures in the circles, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, the hell with this, I am sick and tired of this phenomenon. Why can't it be more direct? I'm going to bed. And I went upstairs, I was staying in his room at that time, and it has those floor-to-ceiling glass doors that open out, you know, onto the field. And I got into my nightgown and got into the bed and was going to read a little bit before I went to sleep. Robert was still downstairs in the kitchen. And suddenly, these tubes of light came shooting down out of that sky like, I mean, I guess, I don't know, a laser bolt or something, but wham!
And you call them tubes of light?
Well, it's what they looked like to me, about a foot wide. And, I mean, scared the hell out of me. The room lights up like Broadway. The field lights up. You can see a half a mile away. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning. And boom, this thing comes down. And it was quick, and then it was gone. And again, I'm thinking, did I really see that? Well, before I can think about it, boom, here comes another one. Right in the same place. By now, I'm thinking, okay, I better get up to this window. And I've swung my legs on a bed. I'm trying to get over to the window. And Robert, in the meantime, has started to go tearing up the stairs because he's been watching it from the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he gets up there, and the third one comes down. And the power was unbelievable. Now, he didn't know that one was coming. He had no idea that thing was getting ready to happen. It caught him as off guard as it did me. We went running downstairs, grabbed the flashlight, neither one of us had the guts to step outside because the power in those lights. I mean, we both knew that if one of them, if it hit you, it would probably fry you to a crisp, and I wasn't about to have that happen. So he's younger. He got up the nerve. He steps outside, and he didn't get zapped, so then I went. And we went to the fence right at the back of his yard, and I shone the flashlight over into that field. It was in string beans that year. And there was a brand new crop circle sitting there, still steaming. Hadn't been there, you know, half an hour before when we'd come in.
Okay, still steaming. Was there really steam coming off of it?
I think that's what I saw. Now, remember, there's a heavy dew in place in Holland, you know, at night, quite a heavy dew. And if this heating agency is part of the crop circle formation process, as Levin Good believes, then that's what I was seeing. I saw what looked to me like steam.
Wow. Okay, you know what? We've got 15 minutes exactly left.
Okay.
Now, for my listeners, what do you think that is important for them to know in this last 15 minutes?
I would think, because these new reports are coming out fairly quickly now, that any of your listeners that are interested in the possibility that all of these so-called anomalous phenomena, UFOs, ETs, crop circles, out-of-body experiences, poltergeist activity, remote viewing, whatever, if they have any interest at all in the possibility that these situations are in fact not separate, but are in fact interrelated, there is something that threads all of these things together. I don't know what it is yet, but through the work with Robert and in a couple of other situations, other cases that I work on too, what I am seeing consistently is that these things which we humans have labeled separately are in fact bits and pieces of the same unknown thing, and that we're probably likely to get closer to the answer about what's going on if we study the whole situation. Rather than insisting on things being separate.
Whereas,
I would suggest they go read very carefully the material that's on the website right now about Robert. It will give them a fundamental, a little background before these next several very heavy reports come out. In which I'm going to be outlining precisely what has happened in one kind of situation after another, with as much evidence as I can provide. For, you know, all the physical evidence, stuff that we've been able to do to show that there's a physical reality to a lot of this. But becoming familiar with that case will help people think about these various phenomena as perhaps interrelated bits and pieces of one big unknown something.
So you think that maybe ghosts, UFOs, crop circles, all sorts of paranormal activity are related.
Things that we currently call paranormal are not necessarily actually paranormal, but simply bits and pieces of some aspect of life, of reality that we just don't know very much about.
Is it some other dimension that we just get glimpses of?
I have wondered. I mean, I'm not saying that I think that it is not possible that extraterrestrial stuff may be going on also. It may. I mean, it may very well be. I don't know. But an awful lot of the things which occur around a couple of these cases that I've worked on, there's this huge range of events which most people have labeled as if they were totally separate things. And yet they're happening in one situation, all these different things. And what I'm beginning more and more to suspect is that there is some area, it has something to do with human consciousness, with the realm of what we call consciousness, which is not to say these things are not physically real. I know that they're physically real and they have physical effects, or they can have. But they're interrelated with human consciousness or cultural consciousnesses, I think. Much of it is. And it's simply an area that science is not generally equipped to deal with. mean, science is set up to deal with physical reality, you know? But I think what we're talking about here is something that interacts with and is a part of consciousness as much as it is a part of the physical world.
Well, what is consciousness? I mean, why do you put that label on it?
If you read Robert's page, you'll start to see it takes time to get to this conclusion. But as I read, as best I can, some of the modern ideas in physics, the whole quantum idea, this whole the notion of the quantum reality, and I become more and more aware of the interrelatedness of everything on Earth, and in fact in the solar system, and I start to recognize that these tiny, tiny, tiny particles that apparently make up everything communicate between themselves completely spontaneously, and distance makes no difference at all. I had a beautiful example of this with Robert, actually, 2 weeks ago. My brother Bill, my brother Nick, the younger one, my brother Bill is the one who died that Robert took pictures of, but Nick, my younger brother, was suddenly acutely ill and had to go to the hospital. He's okay now. He's improving. But at the time, he was in terrible pain. And I was with him, and he was in agony. He could not speak. He was in such pain. And they were not able to take care of the pain. I couldn't stand watching it, and I finally decided to call Robert. Mm-hmm. I have never asked him before. I haven't really paid too much attention to this whole healing thing. It's like another whole realm. But my brother's situation was desperate, and so I called Robert and told him and asked him if there was anything he could do. And he said he didn't know, but he would try. And he's very fond of me, so I knew he would try, and he did. I went back to my brother's room and was with him while watching this. It was about an hour and a half. And all of a sudden, my brother's face changed as if a light bulb had gone off or on. And he looked at me. He could speak all of a sudden. And he said, a miracle just happened. The pain is gone. He didn't know. He did not know that I'd called Robert. He didn't have any. He doesn't believe in this kind of stuff at all. And I actually didn't believe in it either. I just didn't know what else to do. And I didn't say anything to him. I was amazed. I was really kind of flabbergasted. But he stayed out of pain. The doctors were able to get him finally comfortable so he could go to sleep. And, you know, after this operation, and he began his recovery. And now he is recovering and is going to be all right. Once I knew he was all right and could go to sleep, I left. I went home and I called Robert right away to find out. And I said, Robert, I don't know when you started, but it took about an hour and a half, and all of a sudden, the agony was so bad he had tears streaming down his face. And then, turning a light bulb on. And Robert said, that is when it works. That's what his clients tell him all the time. It happens very just instantaneously when it's going to. And he was absolutely overjoyed that it had helped. His only desire is to do that, is to help people. That's what it's not like nailing yourself on a cross. I don't mean that, but that's what he lives for, is to do something that is helpful. And so he was intensely pleased himself to know that it had worked, because he's never certain that it's going to, you know.
But you give him feedback that it did work, and he's happy about that.
Oh, he was thrilled. He was so grateful. And I know that that's partly because he's quite young for 29 in many, many ways. He doesn't, even though all of these incredible events have been going on around him for all of these years, he still is not convinced of his abilities. I mean, his clients are. They line up literally around the block. They are booked a couple years in advance. They swear that he does healings. He also does these other things. They're called readings, where people want to know about relatives who have died or things like that. And he can see the relatives, and he uses now, it used to be he used his own camera, but now he has the client bring their camera, and they hand him the camera, and he takes pictures of their relatives and gives them
back
to them.
So they know there's no trickery involved.
Well, they can see it's their relative.
Well, and this happened to you. I mean, he
it's
took a
to
photo.
Me now a couple times, yeah.
And your deceased brother, Bill, appears in the photo. You sent that photo to me.
Yeah. He didn't appear once. He appeared 60 times out in the middle of a crop circle field in broad daylight. This is
people
all
are crazy. People are going to think this is crazy. This
well,
sounds crazy. It does.
It's,
I mean, I believe you, but I'm
bizarre,
just saying.
Is what it is. It's bizarre. And I don't understand it. I don't. I mean, all I know is that it's real. I have watched Robert like a hawk. We set up all kinds of control situations. I know, because I've been right there for 10 years now. It's real. What it means is what I don't know. Robert says that what he believes, and this is just the best of his knowledge because he doesn't really totally understand it, but at this point in time, as of this year, he tells me that what he thinks is that a cosmic energy or force is functioning through him as a medium to the basic point of it all, whether it's creating crop circles or UFOs or whatever, people who have died. The basic purpose of it is simply to help people open their eyes to the fact that there is this larger reality, that the spiritual reality is real and present, and that people need to become aware of this. This is what he believes it represents. Now, is he correct? I don't know. I don't know either.
It's pretty out there, because almost whenever Nancy, you're talking about healing, you're talking about predicting, it almost seems Jesus-like.
It does to us, because we don't know how to do it. But Robert says, and I think I know he's right about part of this, he thinks that lots of people can do or could learn how to do many of these things. He's shown me how to do some of the stuff. I mean, some of it, he's shown me what he does, and I practiced it, and I could do some of it, too.
What can you do?
Well, these strange light phenomena photos, which there is a report about them on the website right now. I took some of those. And he told me that when the digital camera first came out, he got the idea of to hold it up next to his temple. And then he would simply focus. He has an extraordinary ability to focus himself completely. I mean totally. Like a truck could be coming and he wouldn't hear it. He focuses on being available, being open to just the universe, whatever in the heck it is that's out there. And when you do that, when you get good at that with the camera, you can get all kinds of light phenomena. And I didn't know that. One day it occurred to me to ask him, how in the heck did you learn how to do some of this stuff? And he happened to mention that. Another thing that I learned, and I've seen this happen now, he's learned how to listen to very, very quiet things. He pays attention to things that you would walk right by. It simply wouldn't call your attention. He knows to pay attention to them. The first time I ever saw one of these people appear, we were in his office, and I was trying to photograph him while he made a compass needle spin, which is just one of the things he could do. And there was this very quiet tap, tap, tap at the door. It was so quiet, if Robert hadn't been there, I would never have noticed it. But I did hear it. I would just have kept right on with what I was doing, you know. He turned around to me and said, did you hear that? And I said, yeah. And then I knew, if he was noticing it, I knew something was getting ready to happen. He walks around the desk to my side, asks if he can use my camera, which he hasn't touched before, turns around, aims it at the door, which is 3-4 feet away from both of us, my head right next to his, and he starts taking pictures. And this guy is there. I mean, I jump like I've been shot. There's a man there. And my eyes
are seeing... It's also incredible.
Well, It is. I mean, it is incredible. And, you know, once you've seen it a certain number of times, you start to realize that, okay, all right. I mean, it's trying to name it. You know, most people immediately have to call it something. And my situation is that I don't think we know enough to know what to call it.
End of the broadcast now, and I have really enjoyed this, and I know that people in the chat room have enjoyed it also.
Tell him to go check out his website, and very soon, I mean, the BLT site, I'm putting up a couple more, and then maybe I can come back on and we can discuss some of these reports.
Okay, that's www.bltresearch.com.
And then go to the Vandenbroek case for all of Robert's material.
Paul Robert's material, okay. You know, I have an opening on November the 13th, and we can talk about this later.
That's
but
perfect.
I'd like to have you back on then. Would that
That's
work
perfect.
For you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I finished this next report. It'll be up on the 7th, I think.
Okay. This sounds great.
Same time?
It's just been so interesting. Yep. Same time, same channel. Here we go. Let's see. We're at 11 o'clock. We've got to go. I appreciate you, Nancy, and I appreciate all the listeners and everyone in the chat room. Next week, tune in for Larry Lowe. And here's some news about a new National Geographic film that should be out in December. And I look forward to talking with Larry. Thanks, everyone. Good night.
I've been thinking about you, babe, you're my one desire. Gonna wrap my arms around you and hold you close to me. Oh, babe, I wanna taste your lips, I wanna be your fantasy, yeah. I don't know what I'd do without you, babe, don't know where I'd be. You're not just another lover, no, you're everything to me. Every time I'm with you, baby, I can't believe it's true. When you lay in my arms,